This episode of the Real Fit Podcast is brought to you by the Real Nourished newsletter. Real Nourished, reinventing your relationship with food, is for you if you are ready to stop micromanaging your food and exercise so you can start fully showing up to your life. Each biweekly issue features evidence-based tools that will help reduce your food-related anxiety, improve your body image, and help you embrace exercise as a form of nourishment, not punishment. When you subscribe, you'll get my free guide, 11 things you can do right now to feel better about your body. To get in on it, just click on the link in the show notes or visit my website, pam-more.com.
Moving is such a way to feel empowered and confident and learn so much about yourself and discover who you are. So I think it's, you know, it's so upsetting when you see things like this where it's affecting mental health, physical health, and taking away the joy that's really found in sport and team and camaraderie.
Welcome to the Real Fit Podcast, featuring conversations with women athletes about body image, confidence, enoughness, and so much more. This is a show for any woman who has ever asked herself, am I enough? In a world that's trying to tell us that we're not good enough, we're not thin enough, we're not successful enough, not fast enough, not strong enough, I am here to tell you that you are enough just as you are. And my goal is to share stories and insights that will inspire you and let you know you're not alone. I'm your host, Pam Moore. I'm an occupational therapist turned freelance journalist with bylines in outlets including The Washington Post, Time, The Guardian, Runner's World, Self Magazine, Bicycling, Outside, and many others. I'm also a 2-time Ironman finisher, a 6-time marathoner, a mom of two, and an intuitive eating coach. I'm super excited to share today's episode with you. Before we dive in, I have a quick request. If you have been enjoying this podcast, or if you end up enjoying this particular episode, it would mean so much to me if you haven't already, if you would subscribe to this podcast or follow it, rate it and review it. That helps other people find it, helps me spread that message that you're already enough. Or if you're inclined, share the episode on social media. If you do, I would love if you would tag me. My handle on Instagram is @PamMoore303. On Twitter, I'm @PamMooreWriter. With no further ado, let's do this thing. I am so excited to welcome Elise Cranny to the show today. Originally from Boulder County, Niwot to be precise, she now lives just outside of Portland in Beaverton, Oregon, another running mecca, where she's a professional runner for Nike and the Bowerman Track Club. Before becoming a Bowerman babe in the spring of 2019, Elise was a 12-time All-American at Stanford University. She also finished second at the NCAA championships 4 times. In 2017, notably, she was literally less than a hair away from taking first place in the 1500 meters. That's a 0.0004 second margin, in case you were wondering what less than a hair means. This summer, after winning the trials in the 5000 meters in sweltering 90 degree temperatures in Eugene, she competed in the 5,000 meters at the Tokyo Olympics, making her childhood dream a reality. Elise is also a mentor through Voice in Sport, which is a platform that offers all kinds of support to girls and young women ages 13 to 22. As someone who has been vocal about her own experience with RED-S, which is relative energy deficiency in sport, also known as the female athlete triad, which we're going to get into in this episode, Elise is passionate about giving back to the running community and inspiring the next generation of runners to be the best they can be, both on and off the track. I have personally been following Elise ever since I started getting the local paper, the Boulder Daily Camera, in 2010. Throughout her career at Niwot High School, I would see her face on the cover of the sports page and think, that girl is going places. So I have loved seeing her represent Boulder and later the U.S., and I am so grateful she made time to join me today on the podcast. So welcome to the Real Fit Podcast, Elise Cranny. I'm so happy you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. That was a very kind intro, and I'm glad after 10 years, you know, over 10 years of seeing me in the paper in high school that we could be here talking today. Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
Oh my God, absolutely. I know you've been asked this a million times, but I always start the podcast by asking my guests, what was your relationship with movement and fitness like while you were growing up?
I grew up in a pretty active household. So was exposed to swimming, running. My parents did triathlons growing up. So a lot of things at a really young age. And I feel like some of my earliest memories are even in elementary school and PE class, just doing like the 100-yard dash across the parking lot or the mile run around this grass field. Those were really moments that when I look back on and think were just very like empowering moments for me, where it's like, wow, I feel really confident and alive. I was always just like, I love moving my body. I love being outside. I love feeling the power that comes with propelling yourself forward, whether it be in the pool or on land. I think movement has always been a really big part of my life and something that makes me feel really alive.
Awesome. Okay. So, one thing I didn't mention in your intro, tell me if I got this wrong, but you medaled on the state level as a swimmer in high school. Is that correct?
I never medaled. I made it to the state meet.
Okay.
But didn't medal. Maybe in a couple of relays, but yeah, I qualified for the state meet a couple of years in a row.
Okay. So you're a good swimmer. And one thing that I have noticed is you always say your parents are into triathlon, but I want to point out that in my mind, they're elite triathletes. Like your dad, Bob Cranny, is known as the go-to physical therapist for all the injured triathletes, which there's a lot of us. And he qualified for Kona, I want to say 2 times, and did 10 Ironmans, right? And your mom, your mom, Sandy, also qualified for Kona three times, right?
Yeah, I think she was 2 or 3 times as well. Yeah.
Okay. So your parents aren't just like into triathlon, right? They're pretty awesome triathletes. Was there a point when you made the connection and went, oh, I have good genes from both sides of my family. Like this could mean that I have a real gift here.
The thought about like the genes actually maybe came later when I was like kind of getting more into running. And my dad would always joke, you got all your athletic genes from your mom. I'd say like more so when I was younger though, I think it was more a mentality of just like being surrounded by that and going to, you know, these Ironman triathlons, but also just seeing them train. They were like working and taking care of me and my 2 younger sisters and still making time for, you know, going on these 6 or 7 hour bike rides and then running after. Just being exposed to that mentality of like, we enjoy doing this together and pushing ourselves and making, again, you know, physical activity and movement a priority, even when you have a family and you have a job and they had, you know, starting these physical therapy clinics and their own business, and watching them get better and better and challenge themselves outside of, again, like the family or work world in a very different way. And I think that was really exciting to me.
That's great. And especially to see your mom in that role. I feel like so many women put everything first when they have families and themselves are last.
Yeah.
I know when I go out for a run or a bike ride or whatever, I come home and I feel like I'm such a better mom to my kids because I did that. They don't need me to be there 24/7. They need to see me doing the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And we love that. And it's like, I think when I tell a lot of people that, they're like, oh my gosh, they're working during the weekend and they were gone for, you know, like 7 to 9 hours on the weekend. But it's like my sisters and I, we would wake up and we'd know they'd be back at a certain time and we'd make them eggs or some sort of breakfast. It was just like, again, like you said, really cool to see that they're going to wake up early and do that. And, you know, seeing them do it together and then knowing that we were still going to have time with them when they came back and feeling like we were a part of it again, like even cheering them on at races, like so many memories of having a speaker out there, like on the course, like waiting for them to come by. And I think all of that was just, we felt like we were a part of it, even if we weren't, you know, going out when we were younger and biking or swimming or running with them.
I love that. So for all the moms listening, if you feel like you can't afford to make time for yourselves or you're afraid of what it will do to your kid, Elise Cranny is living proof that nothing is wrong with taking time to work out. Can you see yourself ever doing an Ironman? Is that in your future, perhaps?
I do want to. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
One day, but I feel like I've bottled up too much inspiration over the years. Like again, when we would go to some of those Ironmans, I would go back to the course after my parents finished and be there until midnight with my grandpa. And just, I think I've bottled up enough inspiration to at least get me through one Ironman one day.
That's awesome. I want to have you back on the show after you do your first Ironman. That's
So I actually read an interview where your dad spoke with Buff Zone, and he said that even in high school, you would like get out of the car in Golden to run home 10 miles. He mentioned that like at 11 p.m., you're like not done with your workout for the day. So you're getting changed to go. And I love that. And I think that speaks to how you watched your parents fit everything in. But I'm really curious to know, what would you say is kind of the kookiest or craziest or most outlandish thing you've ever done to fit in a workout when the day got too crazy?
Oh man, that's a great question. I think it would have been the one that my dad was referring to when it was like 11 p.m. This was when I was swimming in high school and we had had the state meet the past 2 days. And then we like went to a team dinner after the state meet had finished. And I was like, I really want to be a part of this. But we went and had this like really big pasta dinner. And I still had this hill workout that I needed to do. So we went out and it was like, I can't remember if it was snowing, but it was like really cold or like on the brink of snowing. And my dad had like a light and it was completely dark. So obviously wasn't feeling amazing trying to run like, you know, 45 minutes after eating a big plate of pasta. That was a tough one. And I think in that moment, you're just like, what are you doing? But also, and I say this a lot, it's like you never regret a workout that you do. So I definitely think when I was like sitting there with my teammates, I was like, wow, the last thing I want to do right now is like go do hill repeats outside in the freezing cold on a full stomach. But yeah, when you finish it and you're like, wow, like I didn't make any excuses for myself. This was a priority and I was going to get it in no matter what, I think is something that again is a really empowering feeling.
Yeah, I love that. And that applies to so many things in life. So many things, whether it's like cleaning out your closet, digging into an assignment at work or whatever it is, just do it, right?
Yeah.
Do what you were going to do. I mean,
Starting is the hardest part, but once you get into it, it's always worth it.
Yeah. So I'm curious, I know you've dealt with injuries. So between injuries and between your high level of performance, and I know that we're going to get into the mental stuff too. I know you've done a lot for your mind. Do you have any like personal policy of like, even if I don't feel like doing it, no matter how tired I feel, or I don't know how I'm going to react given my injury status, I'll start and I'll give it a mile or I'll give it a certain number of minutes. And then if I'm still feeling bad or if I'm feeling worse, then I'll quit. Do you have something like that?
Yeah, I guess I don't think it's really any, like not a specific amount of time or miles, but I think about this a lot is like a lot of times I feel like just in our society, we're really into like instant gratification. So a lot of times we don't want to do the thing that maybe we need to do right now. And it's like, oh, I'd much rather, you know, sit on the couch and snuggle up and watch a show than like go on my double or whatever it is. But I think even just like recognizing that has been huge for me of like, okay, it's normal even since becoming a pro. Like even when this is your job and something that you're really passionate about, there are still days where you don't necessarily want to like lace up your shoes and get out the door for that double. But that's again where I just know that I never regret a workout that I did. Even if it was hard the whole time and it was miserable for most of it, I always finish feeling so much better. So I think that's just what I really try to think of, whether it be like a cross training workout or a running workout. It's like, okay, I just have to like get going and probably get into it like 10 to 15 minutes. And I know that at the end, I'll be a way better version of myself and I'll be glad that I did it. So I try to really channel that when I'm having a rough time.
That's awesome. I'm so curious if this isn't too personal. Are you somebody who's likely to save your money rather than spend it right away?
Yes.
Yeah, I can tell.
Most definitely.
Are you familiar with that study they did with the kids and the marshmallows?
Yes.
Yes. For listeners who aren't familiar, I could be getting the details wrong, but like they gave children a marshmallow and they said like, you can have two later if you can wait till later, or you can have one now. And one of the biggest predictors of success later in life when they looked at these kids, you know, 20, 30 years later, was the kids who would wait so that they could have more marshmallows were, when they stripped away all the other factors, by and large, way more successful than the other kids. So you're definitely somebody who thinks of their future self, which is awesome.
Yes. Yeah. If your listeners haven't watch that, there's like such a great video on that study. It's like the cutest thing ever, where you like see the kids and they're like smelling the marshmallow and it's like torture for them, but it's like so cute because you can just see the kids like, I think sometimes they even did it in pairs and they're telling them to wait and they're like, should we wait? But it's a really cute study.
I will try and find it and link to that in the show notes. So when you're not in the mood, what are you thinking about besides like the immediate, hey, I know I'm going to feel better after I do this workout. Are you also thinking about whatever your next goal is? Like, I know for so long, it was probably, you know, the Olympic trials and then the Olympics. What's motivating you?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely a huge thing is like thinking of the goals too. And that's where you talk about your future self. It's like, maybe I don't want to do this today, but I know, like, for example, leading up to the trials, it was like everything that you didn't want to do. It was like, I know that when I stand on the trials, I'm going to want to be fully confident in my preparation. And the only way to do that is to have known I did everything I could. So it's like those days that you didn't want to do that weight session or you didn't want to do that double, like knowing that all of those things prepare me to stand on that line fully confident. So I think, to your question, after having experienced the Olympics this summer, I feel like it just really opened my eyes to running at that level because I hadn't raced against many of those women before. Watching how they go about things, how they race, and really wanting to be like, okay, I want to be really competitive on the stage. Like, I want to be competing to be top five and be in medal contention. And next year is World Champs and it's in Eugene. So the big goal is qualifying to make that team and then trying to really use what I learned from the Tokyo Olympics. If I'm able to make that team and, you know, hopefully be more competitive with the best in the world. It's funny because this has been this huge dream and goal for so long, but it also feels like this restarting point. My eyes have been open to this whole new world and I'm really excited about trying to level up and get the most out of myself on an international level moving forward.
That's amazing. I know most of my listeners are probably not Olympians, but we all have things, you know, maybe it's a wedding or moving into a new home or a marathon or an Ironman, whatever it is. There's always that sense of, okay, my eye was on the prize for so long. Now I've done it. And you have like, this is my experience at least, is like, I'll have like a week of like, oh, I'm kicking back. I'm eating all the ice cream. I'm going for walks. I don't want to run. I don't want to do. And then like kind of a letdown. You don't have the endorphins. You don't have the goal. You're mentally a little drained. Have you dealt with this like sort of post-event blues?
Yeah, it is. It is kind of crazy. I'm glad that I did some racing in Europe right after, because if I had just like completely ended the season right after the Olympics, I think it would have even been kind of like this steeper drop. I think especially this year, it was just weird not having fans or any friends or family there. It was kind of like, I don't know. I feel like I got back and it was kind of jarring because it was like, did that actually happen? Because you're like trying to share with family and friends, but it's hard to put into words and really share what that experience is like. So you're like, whoa, like, did that happen? Because suddenly you're in Tokyo and then you're just back in Beaverton, back in the same routine. But I also think for me, that was helpful because it was like, okay, I'm still focused on a couple more races. And I feel like I learned a lot from this experience racing in Tokyo. Like, I want to put that into practice moving forward. But I would definitely say since returning to Portland, I've been in a little bit of a funk just because it's like getting back into your normal routine. And I think it's kind of like, whoa, this whirlwind of a summer that again was so built up to be with the postponement of the Olympics. And it really is. It's a little bit of just like, okay, like kind of finding that motivation again and looking to find that next goal. Cause it definitely can be like, okay, I've achieved this like really big goal or this experience, this really big event. And what do I do now? How do I move forward? There's definitely been like a lot of self-reflection in that and being like, okay, what can I find that is exciting me moving forward? And how can I use that experience to move forward and also still savor it and take it in? So that's definitely something that I've been working on and balancing for sure.
Hey, it's Pam with a quick interruption. If you are ready to heal your relationship with food, exercise, your body, if you're ready to stop stressing about the scale, if you're ready to stop trying to shrink your body and have a much, much, much bigger life where you can really be present, I can help you. I am an intuitive eating coach with a background of over 10 years as an occupational therapist. I've also done health and fitness writing for publications including The Washington Post, Self, Runner's World, Bicycling, Outside, The Guardian, Time. And I have also, as you probably know, been on my own journey to heal my relationship with food and body image. If you want to know more about how I can help, check out my website. I'm at pam-more.com. You can also just scroll down in the show notes. There's a link there.
Also, I talk about all this stuff in my bi-weekly newsletter. If you're not already a subscriber, scroll on down in the show notes. Just click on the link to sign up. When you do, you'll get my free download, 11 things you can do right now to feel better about your body.
Yeah. So I have a couple questions. So one is, I do want to know, what is the biggest lesson you learned at the Olympics? You know what? And I'll save my other question for after you answer.
I think the biggest thing is just, I've kind of known this, but it was just so much more clear to me when I was like standing on that line, is just like the mental side of sport, but really like anything you do and like having confidence in yourself. I think the way that I lined up in the prelim versus the final was very different. Now that I look back, like I was very confident in the prelim. I was like, I just have to be top five. I can do that. I feel very prepared. And then I think suddenly, you know, 3 days later, I felt, okay, like this is the final. And I think in my mind, I was like, oh, it's something different. Now we're not maybe racing as conservatively because we're not just trying to qualify. This is the final. But it's like, I was racing against all the same people that I had in the prelim, but there was just this mindset shift where I think suddenly I was like, oh, I don't see myself as being on this level with these people because I've never raced against them before. And I think that was a really big learning piece for me, is just confidence and how that impacts how you feel in the race and how you race. I don't feel like I ever properly put myself in the race. I was kind of at the back of the pack the whole time. And I just think if you're already not lining up as confident and now you find yourself kind of getting detached and reattaching at the back of the race, that's also just confirming those beliefs. Just seeing like how the people that medaled or were in the top, how they really carried themselves, and even going back and watching the race, like how they stood on the line, like very confidently, you know. And you're nervous. You're never not nervous because you care about it, but you could definitely tell there was a confidence to how they were standing on the line, how they were making moves in the race, you know, being a much more active participant in the race instead of kind of, I felt like I was racing pretty passive in the final of like, oh, these people are making the moves and I'm trying to attach, instead of like really taking that ownership over what I was doing and having that confidence. I think that was really the biggest thing that I learned, which is, you know, frustrating that I don't feel like I could have that in the final, but also really exciting because that's something that's very much within my own control, and something that I can, you know, work on day in and day out moving forward.
Yeah. I feel like that really parallels. I listened to you talking to Allie Feller on Allie on the Run, and you might've mentioned it in other interviews too, but the experience of joining the Bowerman Track Club and getting dropped on so many workouts at the beginning, but like you just kept showing up and showing up and showing up and controlling what you could control. And it seems like this was a little bit of that. And it's just like, you only had one chance, right? Now you have more chances, but right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. I mean, and that's like very much a parallel. And I think, again, why then when I race in Europe, I was excited because it felt like, okay, this isn't the Olympics, but I feel like I'm getting a couple more races this season to put this into practice, what I just learned. In a lot of ways, that was what was really cool about first joining the Bowerman Track Club. And even though it doesn't feel that great in the moment, because you feel like you're just leaving every practice defeated, you're having so many tangible things to work on, which is just amazing. And I think my college coach said that a lot. And this is something like I really focus on, is just like setting both process and outcome goals. So you have that big outcome goal, whatever it is, right? In life or running or triathlon or anything. But you also, you kind of, he would say, like you set that on the shelf and you put it aside and you keep that in the back of your mind. But what's really keeping you going on a day-to-day basis is those process goals. So those smaller goals that you can like tangibly see you're making progress, and those also help you get confidence. And so I think that's what's really was huge for me when I first joined Bowerman Track Club too. It's like you were really seeing, I feel like I was really seeing myself accomplish those process goals on a regular basis. And it was something that I really had to stay grounded in, because I was like, I can't compare it to my teammates because I'm finishing maybe 50% of the workouts, but maybe I was like, you know, tougher and made it a little bit further today, or I really worked on my positive self-talk in that workout, even though I still only made it 3/4 of the way. So I think, you know, all of those things. And then, as you said, taking those lessons in racing too, and like, okay, what are small things that I can apply next time. And then it does feel, again, really empowering. And I think helps you build confidence when you're doing that moving forward. And it really allows you to focus on yourself and be less prone to comparing to others, because you're seeing the progress that you're making against yourself instead of comparing that to what anyone else is doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I like that. And I think so many of us, especially with social media, we're so prone to looking at other people. Like my husband always says, don't compare your inside to their outside. Like you don't mm-hmm. know where they've been or what they've done to get where they are. You don't know anything. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I love that. Someone told me, but was like, everyone, if you think of everyone like a book, you might be comparing, like when you look on social media, you might be comparing to someone's like middle of the book and you might be on chapter one or chapter two. But I think the social media piece is really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's say that. It's really, it says, an Olympian is telling us it's really hard. So everyone, it's really hard. You're not alone. And actually, I'm glad you mentioned this piece about the journey, because it's a good segue. Part of your journey has been dealing with red S, as in relative energy deficiency in sport, which is, tell me if I got this right, but it's when female athletes underfuel, which results in not getting their period, which contributes to low bone density, which contributes to injuries, which are normally stress fractures. It's also been called the female athlete triad. And I'm really curious if you want to add anything to that, but really to hear about your experience and what was helpful to you in recovery.
Yeah. Yeah, you nailed it.
Okay.
On.
Yes.
I think the one thing is like, which, you know, it impacts both males and females. I think that's something that's really cool about what we have as females in terms of the tool that we have in our periods, because it is like the most concrete thing to let us know if we're under overfueling. So, you know, the biggest thing with red S is, yeah, that your energy output is greater than your energy input. So you're not getting enough. And yeah, I think the earliest kind of thing that I think of with me and my story is just losing my period in high school and not knowing that that was a very bad thing and something that was going to like impact my long-term health and development. It's really crazy looking back. I think it's slowly starting to change, but just the narrative that's like really upsetting of like, okay, like you lose your period when you're like getting fit or you're training hard enough and it's a good thing to lose your period. A lot of friends that I had outside of running that were like, oh, you're so lucky you don't get like a period in high school. And I was like, oh yeah, I am. Like, I don't have to deal with that. But realizing that was just like years of not properly taking care of my body, and it eventually is going to catch up with you. And I think it catches up to people at different points, but that's just something that I'm really passionate about now, is like trying to inform people at a younger and younger age that it's not normal to not get a regular period. And it's really, really important to fuel properly and adjust your training. Like maybe you need to back off your training a little bit to make sure you're getting a regular period, and especially females, just like making sure that you're not staving off puberty or stunting your development in any way is so crucial. That's something that, yeah, I wish I would have known earlier, because it was like, as I've said before, it's like it was bubbling under the surface. Everything is fine until at one point, my sophomore year of college, like it came to a head when I got my first big bone injury. So I had a stress fracture in my sacrum, and it felt like it just came out of nowhere. But then when you stop and look back, you're like, okay, this like makes sense. I wasn't properly taking care of my body. And then from there, I just got stuck in a cycle of stress fractures and stress reactions. And that's a point where I was like, wow, I really need to do something. Like this is a really serious thing that I need to address, and I need to get a regular period, because I can't, you know, keep having low bone density, and I can't be kind of living in this state, you know, for my long-term health, regardless of performance.
If you're a writer or an aspiring writer who wants to know exactly what it takes to break into your dream publications, I have something just for you.
It's a 34-page ebook I wrote called Seven Pitches That Sold. And in it, I share everything I wish I'd known when I started out as a freelance writer. It also includes seven pitches that turned into assignments for outlets including Runner's World, The Washington Post, and Outside Magazine. Use the code REALFIT50 at checkout to get half off, because friends don't let friends pay full price. And the link where you can purchase it is in the show notes.
So I have a couple questions. One, I'm curious about socially what it did to you. Like, we do so much with food socially and trying to control your intake. I'm guessing you were hungry and kind of micromanaging the food. That's one. And also two, wondering, was there a period of time between when that small voice inside of you or your doctor or somebody in your life said to you, Elise, you need to gain weight so that you can get your period, and then the time when you actually were like, okay, I need to do this. Was there a lag? So yeah, talk to me more about like the mental piece of it, and then the, how did you make the flip?
I think the biggest thing when you talk about, you know, the eating is like your brain kind of convinces you that it's like small things, but it becomes such a slippery slope, right? Like for me, it's like, okay, now you're taking out salad dressing, you're taking out butter, I'm not going to eat dessert. And it's like, so in, it all seems very small, but it adds up to this really big thing of like, wow, I'm really restricting and I'm really cutting out the things that my body needs and is craving and that I should be giving. And I'm now trying to do something that's very like unnatural. And as you said, you know, you're in a social situation. It's like, it's very anxiety inducing. Maybe you're going out for ice cream and it's like, how many times are you going to be like, no, I'm like too full from dinner. Looking back, it's just like, you kind of realize like the wear and tear that it takes in a social setting. And also just like, yeah, the energy, I feel like that it's constantly taking, because it's like, you kind of have something subconsciously just running all the time, overthinking everything. Should I eat this? Should I eat that? Especially when you get to college, it can be really hard because it's like you now have access to all these different choices at the dining hall. And I think it can make it really exhausting if you're in a state of like, are you like actually listening to what your body wants? Or are you trying to fight that and make a decision based on what you think is like, quote unquote, healthy? And then I would say to your other question, I think the biggest moment was after I first got that sacral stress fracture, I got a bone density scan, and a doctor sat me down and was like, your bone density is really bad. You can only build bone density for a finite time when you're young, and then you can't build it anymore. When I started to think about it in those terms and really picture my bones being frail and like thinking, wow, if I can't build bone density for the rest of my life and I'm messing up basically this crucial period of time to build really strong bones, not just for running, but just living the whole rest of your life. I was like, I do not want to have frail bones. I think that was kind of an image that was really powerful to me. But then, as you said, there's definitely a lag time. Like when you have these deeply ingrained thoughts and habits, it's like you can rationally be like, wow, yeah, I need to make this change. But it takes a lot of energy to fight those things that were just, you know, habitual thoughts and patterns. I think that kind of showed as I continued to get some stress reactions and stress fractures. It's just like, I feel like it wasn't quite like fully committing, but it's like when I got to the point where I had a couple more, I think the mindset shift was you have to change something. And I think it was helpful for me when someone told me, you can change and start fueling properly and get a regular period. And you may be scared of, you know, gaining weight or performing at the same, because now you haven't had a regular period for so long. But the alternative is like continuing to get bone injuries. And I was just like, okay, I know what that's like. I've now experienced that. So it's like, I'm going to try this other piece. And I think it was helpful when someone was like, you can always go back to what you were doing before. You can go back to your bad habits, to your, you know, under fueling. And I think just having that option for some reason was really helpful. But like, they knew, like,
once you
make those changes, you're going to realize that you're a much happier, healthier version of yourself. You feel way stronger and more powerful, less irritable, all of those things. But kind of knowing like, okay, you have two options, like the one that you're doing right now is not working. So like, you got to try something else.
Yeah. So it had to get to the point where it was clearly not working. But what I'm sort of astounded by is, So you had the bone density scan and the physician was like, you got to build your bone density. But prior to that, had any of your coaches who, you know, must have known that you had injuries, did any of them ask you, or was it part of like an intake form or anything you did as a team to talk about when the last time you got your period was?
Yeah, we did. We, in college, they were kind of doing like, a study in terms of like bone. I think that's kind of ended up how we got the bone density scan. And so there were some intake forms on that, but I think that's where I'm really happy we're having this conversation. I hope it continues to be talked about because it is, I think, still shocking to me about the number of teams that are not like closely monitoring female athletes' periods from the minute that they get there. I would say, especially with freshman and sophomore when you first came in. I think it's really easy to happen. Like I said, I wasn't getting a period all freshman year, but like I was running really well. And so I don't think there's any point where you're like, oh, I need to like look at something, but that's just like a story that's all too common. That's so upsetting because it's like you almost don't realize it's a problem until now you've, you know, been in something 2, 3, 4 years and you've done a lot of damage where you're stuck in this injury cycle. Yeah. And I think that's something that's still like so upsetting.
Had there been female coaches in your life or female mentors, do you think it would have been a different conversation? It's hard for me to imagine like a couple of guys coaching a bunch of teenage girls being like, ladies, let's talk about your period.
I had great female assistant coaches in both high school and college, which was awesome. But I think that's where it still needs to come, I feel like, from the head coach, especially in high school. It's like you're not necessarily going to start this conversation that maybe you already feel awkward about talking, even if it is a female coach. Yeah. And so it's like, I think there needs to be more at the beginning of a season or a year, like more concrete of like, you may go to this assistant coach or come to me, you know, like just really open the floor for that. Even just sending out like a resource guide of here's some podcasts that talk about red S, nutrition, your period, etc. Here's a couple articles and a couple podcasts. And like, I want you guys to listen to it as a team, whether it be in high school or college. And I think even if you don't necessarily discuss them, just putting those out there so people know that they can learn from that. And then maybe they can go to coaches with specific questions, or then maybe things will come up for them and they'll do some reflection of like, okay, like I need this or that. If I would have had that in high school, a couple articles or something yeah. about people trying to, you know, change their bodies or how detrimental it is to not get a period, I think that really just opens the conversation and makes people feel more comfortable. Because I think right now, in my opinion, if it's on like a high school female to find someone and go up to them and like not know how to start this conversation, it just feels like there are too many barriers.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, I know they say as a parent, like I'm trying to figure out how to talk to my kids about sexuality or sex or food or all the things. And everything I've learned is there isn't like one big talk. It's a myth that there's the talk about anything. It's give them the information in small bites and on a frequent basis. And even if like, say you are talking about sex and your kid is like, ew, mom, that's disgusting. I don't want to talk about that with you. I'm like, fine. I don't mind embarrassing you if it means that 5, 10, 15 years from now, you know that I'm a safe person to come to if anything is up with you. Like I'm just planting the seeds. And it sounds like planting those seeds, whether it's like a handout, a policy, just something to say, this is a safe person. You don't have to be the one to start this conversation.
Yeah.
Really big.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I do. I think it's so important, you know, like in those small bites like that. Even I've had, you know, some male coaches reach out and be like, how do I start this conversation? That's what I say. Just like send out a podcast. Just make it clear that you are available. And I was like, you don't have to have the right words. You're probably going to feel awkward. They're probably going to feel awkward at first, but you don't have to know exactly what to say. You just need to say, hey, I'm here. We can have an open and honest dialogue. If I don't have the answer, I'll like send you some resources or I'll send you to someone else that could help you. And I think it's just, that's where, yeah, again, I get so like sad and frustrated because I'm like, it just seems like such a small change. You just have to let them know that you're there and willing to talk about it. Especially male coaches, like you don't have to understand everything. You don't have to know how to talk about periods. You just have to say something, like anything and then agree to like send someone in the right direction or get them the help they need.
Yes, I love that. So in light of all this, what about the situation coming out of Oregon? Just to fill in listeners who aren't aware, the Oregon running program, it's has been alleged to have some really toxic culture around weighing people and DEXA scans with the body fat analysis. And several women came forward to the media and said they felt like they had a good relationship with food and it deteriorated very quickly as they were part of the team. And some have binge eating problems now and all kinds of problems. Well, how did you feel when you heard or read about that?
It was just heartbreaking, I think, is the first thing that comes to mind. And we've, you know, had multiple conversations now on runs, like in the last week or so since it came out. And I think the first thing is a little bit of disbelief. And I guess I shouldn't really feel that anymore because it seems like it's still such an issue. But I just feel like, you know, as we've talked about kind of the whole narrative around even periods, sometimes it's still just so shocking to me that I just feel we're so like far behind where we need to be with that sort of stuff. When you look at high school and collegiate programs, it's so heartbreaking because we're just at such a young age during that time. You're so malleable. And it's like the coaches and the people that you have around you, it's just they carry so much weight. The words they say mean so much to you because you're just in a state of wanting to like learn and grow as a person. And so I think that's what's, you know, so upsetting, as you talked about, is just like how now, you know, maybe they didn't have issues before and how this culture or it coming from coaches or the top of a program can create issues for the rest of your life. And I think that's really sad. I think especially when sport is such a cool thing and such a powerful, this goes all the way back to the beginning, like moving is such a way to feel empowered and confident and learn so much about yourself and discover who you are. So I think it's, you know, it's so upsetting when you see things like this, where it's affecting mental health, physical health, and taking away the joy that's really found in sport and team and camaraderie and all of that stuff. The more news you hear about it, the more you're just like, we need to make change now. And I know it doesn't happen overnight, but I think in both high school and college, it's kind of shocking that there's still such a focus on weight and body composition because we're not mastering like the 99%. Why are we not talking about healthy sleep habits in a college athlete? All of those things are going to go way further in performance than someone's body composition. I feel like we're missing the mark. Why don't we spend more time talking about how to balance school to prioritize sleep, how to recover from workouts, how to fuel our body properly, how to have more resources with sports psych or psychologists to really hone into the mental side. All of that is way more telling of performance than weight or body comp. It's more about how you feel than the number on the scale or body comp. Is like, I don't weigh myself at all anymore. I focus on how I feel. Like, am I feeling strong? Am I recovering from workouts? And am I getting a regular period? Then I know I'm doing a good job fueling. And I think that should be the focus. You want to send the people to compete that are feeling strong and feeling really good and empowered and happy people. And that's going to be not focusing so much on that weight and body comp and just being like, this person is feeling really strong in training because they're taking care of their mental and physical health. And as coaches in a program, we're encouraging them to do that.
Yeah. 100%. And it totally aligns with what you said about your early days with the Bowerman Track Club and focusing on the process instead of the outcome. Like, the process is, can I control my sleep? Can I control my nutrition? Mm-hmm. Can I get in the weight room? Can I stretch? Can I do the ice bath? Can I go to PT? All those things. Those are the things you can control. It's the outcome you can't necessarily. And so you can do all the right thing, the quote unquote right things. And like, your body comp is going to do what it's going to do unless you're depriving yourself and creating an unsustainable situation.
Yeah.
So it's like, always focus on the habits, right?
Yeah, totally. That's where like, that's going to inherently help you get to your outcome goal. Because if you're focused on the habits, like, that's where you're getting the confidence. You don't want to be setting the precedent in a program of, we get our confidence in a race based on a number on a scale. Cause it's like, I think about this all the time, even with body checking in the mirror. My body looks completely different when I wake up in the morning after a workout, before I go to bed at night, after a meal, depending where I am in my cycle. And I even feel that way with like weight and body comp. It's like, it's so fluid. Are you hydrated? Are you dehydrated? I'm just like, it's not a good metric. It's changing so much. So we need to focus on the things that, that are more reliable, metric. And like you said, things that we can control.
Yes. At the East Boulder Rec Center, I was swimming the other day and I noticed that the scale there, which I don't go on the scale anymore, but it says on it, healthometer. And I wanted to like take a Sharpie and X it out. I'm like, this is not a healthometer. Yeah. This is literally measuring one metric that is not to do with health.
Yes. Yes.
But going back to the disordered eating, I don't know if you follow Amelia Boone on social media. She's an endurance athlete who's spoken openly about her eating disorder. And she asked the question on Twitter and I can't get it out of my head. She asked, what does it mean? Or maybe it was Instagram. Doesn't matter. What does recovery mean? Like, is recovery possible? And what does it look like? Does it look like never overthinking your food? Does it look like just being better than you were? Like, and I'm sure it's different for every person, but what does recovery look like to you? And do you feel like you're as recovered as you're going to get, or is there more for you?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a super interesting question. I think like you said, I think it's different for every person, but for me, it's something where it's also like, okay, there are probably still going to be times where you like overthink and you have to challenge these thoughts that were really deeply ingrained. I think kind of a moment that sticks out to me is my first altitude camp a couple months into joining Bowerman. You're living with people on the team now, and it can be such an intense environment. And the fact that like you're surrounded by people that have like made Olympic teams and done the things that you want to do. And it's really cool because you're learning from them and you're picking up things that you could do better, but it can kind of be this big comparison trap because now it's very in your face of like, this is what someone who has made an Olympic team is eating. This is like what cross training they're doing, et cetera, et cetera. A big piece for me was when I went to that first altitude camp, even if there were a lot of thoughts that were constantly coming up that I was having to challenge, the fact that I was really focusing on, okay, what is going to work best for me? I know I have figured out that this is what I need to fuel properly. And that may be more than this person over here, even though I'm running less mileage, even though I'm doing less cross training. But I think feeling like I had the strength to do that and to be able to say, okay, even if these teammates are doing more mileage and they're still adding like a bike or a swim or something else, I'm going to take this afternoon to rest and recover because these workouts are a lot more intense for me. And I know that's what my body needs. And I'm still going to fuel just the same as I would, even though I'm not doubling or not doing something else. I'm not going to like adjust my fueling because I'm doing less or things like that. Having more of that awareness and feeling my own voice was finally overpowering that other voice of like wanting to give in to these things that were very triggering before that I would have just done, especially in a new environment when you have people that you're looking up to and you want to be, but knowing like, okay, I can still look up to them and learn from them, but I need to stick with what I know is working best for me. And even though I'm needing to remind myself that, and it's hard, that was just a moment that I think back to that I'm like, okay, like you're able to have that strength to know what you need, and not let your brain run away and take you to a place that you don't want to go back to.
That's so powerful. And I think that's so powerful, not just from like an eating perspective, but from a life perspective. Like, we're all on our own journey.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what somebody else is doing. If you know who you are and you know from the inside what you need, not from, oh, this app told me to do it, social media told me to do it, oh, look at them over there. It's always about finding your compass. And I just think that's such an important message. I think a common myth about intuitive eating, which it sounds like you're an intuitive eater based on, I think you were talking to, was it Emma Abrahamson on Coffee and Cold Brews and Conversation?
I feel like
you were telling, like there's a lot of C's in it. I feel like you were telling her about intuitive eating. And I was like, yeah, right on. I think a huge myth about intuitive eating is people say, oh my gosh, if I ever started down that road, all I'd eat is ice cream or donuts or cookies, like eating whatever you want. And then of course there's people who would say, oh my gosh, but I can't trust myself. I don't trust myself to ever eat a salad again or to ever eat broccoli again if I'm eating intuitively. But so I guess I'm wondering, A, what does intuitive eating mean to you? And B, what advice would you have for somebody who is genuinely curious but isn't sure where to start or is too afraid that they'll gain weight?
The first thing I think of regarding intuitive eating is when I was in college, I actually went to kind of this presentation about like body positivity. And that's where like I had first heard the concept intuitive eating. And I still just like vividly remember this whole section on intuitive eating because it was so powerful to me. And it was kind of along the same lines that you said, because I felt that way. It was like, oh, well, then I'm just going to keep eating like cookies or cake and I'm never going to want to eat a vegetable again. But the woman that was speaking was like, your body like knows what it wants. Like you would go a certain amount of time eating cookies and cake. And she was like, you might not believe it, but like you will crave a salad or you would crave something salty, something that's basically the opposite of what you're eating. And the one other example that she had was, you know, when you think about when your kids, like in kids are really good at intuitive eating, like that they stop when they're full, they eat when they're hungry, like they, you know, eat things that sound good, but they also know how to, you know, eat their like vegetables or protein or whatever it is. She gave this example of a kid eating cake at a birthday party. And I think it might've been, I don't remember if it was like her own daughter or something, but it was like, she was at a birthday party and she came up to me and asked if she could have a piece of cake. And I was like, yeah. And then she came back and she asked for a second piece of cake. And I said, yeah. And then she came back and asked for a third piece. And I said, yeah. And after the third piece, she was like, I feel sick. That third piece tasted way less good than the first piece. Kids are really good at like next time, maybe they would only have two pieces, or maybe then you realize like you felt pretty full and kind of sick of the cake 1.5 pieces in. That was something that just really stuck with me of like, okay, trying to approach it more as trial and error and not like the end all be all sort of thing. And I think that's been really helpful for me, right? It's like, okay, if you're eating a meal or you're eating ice cream or some sort of dessert, it's like, okay, I felt really good today when I had 2 scoops of ice cream. And then maybe another day, like I have 3 scoops and I'm like, I felt really full and now I feel like sick. And it's like next time I would go back to having 2 scoops because that's when it was enjoyable and I wasn't feeling like I was so full or sick of the sugar or whatever. And I would say like anyone who wants to try it is just really kind of approaching it with that trial and error. And I think for me, it was like even important to take some of the emotion out of it and be very methodical about it. I think for me, it's really been powerful because you're taking ownership over your body and really listening to what it wants. And I think that's even where you were saying earlier, I think it's crazy in the world today of social media and marketing and advertising, everything. It's so easy to lose track of what we know is best for us. And I think when you were talking about that, it reminded me of something my dad said, what's best for you, Lisa? Like you can surround yourself by you know, nutritionists, PTs, people to tell you what exercises would be good to do in weight room, what training is good, coaches, all of those things. But at the end of the day, you have to trust that you are the only person that knows best for you. And I think that's just something that's really stuck with me too. And I think that goes to the intuitive eating piece as well. It's like my body knows what it wants. So I need to listen to it. And I think it's hard because we're being bombarded with so much information and, you know, societal pressure and all of these things of like, this food is quote unquote bad, this food is quote unquote good. But I think seeing, like trying to see no food as good or bad of just like, what does my body feel like? And can I give it that is really important. And so that's what I would say is like really focusing on that and seeing it as like that trial and error process and like really being kind to yourself along the way. Cause it's just about getting back in tune with your body and learning what it's actually telling you instead of like maybe thinking you know, but it's being influenced by all of these outside sources.
Yes. Yes. That's so great. And I feel like it's like you said before, like what if you did eat 3 pieces of cake and it was too much? Well, it's not if, like you said, don't overthink it or don't overanalyze, just use it as information. It's like, that's not a failure necessarily. That's information. It's information about, okay, so that was too much cake. Moving on. not yeah. going to go into this hole. And that makes me XYZ. Mm-hmm. No, it's not about your character. It's just, I ate too much cake, full stop.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, and I what think about,
that's the most, sorry.
No, you go. Say,
I think that's the most important piece again, like where you're kind of taking that emotion or making it more than it is out of it. It's just like, yeah, I had too much and I felt sick. So next time I'll have a little bit less. And that's good. Like all of that is like seeing that is really helpful information. Cause it's like, if you didn't have those three pieces of cake, you wouldn't have known how much was too much. And so now you know for next time. And I think as you consciously think about that more and do it, it just becomes easier and easier because you're just continually getting little bits of information. So, you know, yeah. you know, or even yeah. like, depending on the person, it's like, maybe you do well, like eating more frequently throughout the day. Maybe you do well, like having bigger meals, like whatever, you know, but just like identifying that for yourself and then really trusting. And then you can have a lot of confidence when you go into a snack or meal, cause you're like, I know what my body wants. And I'm getting to the point where I also know when to stop before I'm like too full or I feel sick because I'm really listening to my body and the cues it's giving me.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you get over the fear or anxiety about, well, what if I gain weight? Will that, you know, even though at that time that you got into all this, you were too injured, I think, to run, but knowing, oh my gosh, maybe I won't be the athlete that I was if I'm heavier. Did you have those fears and how did you deal with those?
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely had those fears. So it's kind of that mentality of like really having to take that leap of faith is like, you have these people telling you like, you'll be stronger. This will be much more sustainable, like all of these things, but it definitely requires taking a leap of faith because you haven't experienced it yourself. And it's really easy to stay stuck in what you know, because that's what's worked for you. And even though you've, maybe gotten injured now or been in a cycle, it's like, you're like, yeah, but it still worked for me because I still was able to do all of these things. But I think the big piece was just knowing I can't keep doing this. So if that means gaining some weight and not being as fast, well, to me, that's better than not running at all. And I actually think, Ali Ostrander, who's been really outspoken, on social media as well. She's also a runner, about eating disorders recently. She said something, I think it was just last week, she had a caption that was really powerful to me on this point. It was like, would you rather be a runner or look like a runner? And I was just like, wow, like that put into words what I was feeling in college, where it was like, I, at this point, like if I don't quote unquote look like a runner, which is crazy because runners are all different sizes and shapes and you don't have to look a certain way to be a runner. That's where I started to get to is like, I can't keep doing the same thing. So if I gain weight and don't look like I did in high school, which I shouldn't have looked like I was in high school, you know, now as a 20, 21, 22 year old. But I think that was kind of, I hadn't put words to it until I saw her caption, but I think that was my approach, was like, I'd rather be at least able to run and train with my team and be healthy instead of be stuck in the pool, regardless of how I look, than to not be able to run at all.
Yes. Yes. And I'm so glad that you mentioned it's not normal that a woman in her 20s would look like she did in her teens. And there was a really good article in the New York Times a few years ago when the whole Mary Kane thing blew up. And they were talking about Mary Kane and they were talking about Melody Fairchild also, who up until Mary Kane, like Melody Fairchild was like the prodigy. And they got into this like false expectation that a girl is going to run the same way after puberty and compare and acting like girls are just versions of boys, the way our development is. Like, we're not supposed to be in our peak years in college. It's going to be for most women in your late 20s that you get much more fast and much more powerful and develop the muscle mass to support that power. It doesn't happen all at once. So it's let's adjust the expectation to what women's bodies actually are and what they actually do.
Yeah. Going back briefly to social media, that's something that really, really worries me right now about particularly high school and collegiate female athletes, because I think being able to follow professional female athletes is great, but I think it sets a false expectation, A, of like the training load, and B, of like body image, body type, because it's like a 30-year-old professional runner or marathoner that has been doing, you know, high mileage weeks, has fully developed, should not look like an 18-year-old, a 20-year-old, a 24-year-old, a 28-year-old. And I even remember when I was in college, like looking at a lot of professional runners or looking at, like, you know, Shalane Flanagan or people and being like, oh, is that what I need to look like? It's just like so upsetting to me, that piece of social media, because it's really hard to take a step back and realize, yes, as a 22-year-old, I should not be looking like, you know, a 32-year-old marathoner who's been doing 100-plus-mile weeks for longer than I've been running. But it's very hard to do, you know, and that's where I even think of, for a while, I feel like I was comparing myself toward the end of college to what I looked like in high school. And I was like, oh, I need to look like that again. It's like, 22-year-old Elise should not look like 15-year-old Elise. There's probably a big underlying problem if that's the case. Even when you talk about the Mary Kane situation, is like, I like hope that's where collegiate programs can get to too, is celebrating the long-term development of female athletes and bringing them along. And I just feel like for Mary, when she graduated and didn't have college, there was even less of that time to have that development and go through that. And I think of that, you know, for me, I'm like, I'm so glad that I was in the college system, because I can't even imagine like the pressures on a 19-year-old when your body's changing and there's just not the same time and space, I think, as I felt like I had in my collegiate program to let my body change and really address the like underlying root causes and go through that. And I hope moving forward that more collegiate programs can approach it that way, where it's like a space where we're going to like develop female athletes, and it may take a little bit longer. And it may be like, you know, we're running our best in college, like our senior and fifth year in comparison to our freshman year, and then, you know, beyond. But that's like so much more important than just trying to like, again, stave off development longer and get the performance while we can. And I think that's just the biggest piece that makes me sad, is when performance comes at the expense of mental, physical, long-term health and development. And I think if we just switch that, we'd actually realize that overall performance would actually come along with that and be much, much more fruitful and much more sustainable. And there'd be much more longevity if we just help people take a step back and not go all in on performance when maybe someone maybe not be in a healthy state.
Yes, yes. And I think one of the most powerful ways that we can spread that message is through stories. People don't hear lectures, right? They resonate with stories. They resonate with emotions. And so I think that you, like, coming on my podcast and doing all the interviews you've done and all of that, it makes a difference, you know, that people can hear your story and know there could be something better for me on the other side if I will give up these unhealthy, unsustainable habits.
Even when I think back, there were times in college where I was like, maybe my body can't handle it. Maybe I'm done running. The message I hope to convey now is like, if you fully embrace it, and it's so hard. And there were so many times where you're doubting if your body can do it, where it's like really hard to change those deeply ingrained things and get that regular period back. But it's like, if I hadn't gone all in when I did, I wouldn't be here. Like, I wouldn't have made that Olympic team. I wouldn't probably still be running. And it's like, that really needed to happen. And you need to go through that. And there, you know, a lot of ups and downs in that. And maybe at first it's like really adjusting to getting a regular period and learning to train with that and all of those things. And it can be a learning curve, but it's so worth it. When I made those changes, like, way less irritable, way less anxious, a way happier person. I could be so much more present. Like, I enjoyed the last couple of years of my time in college so much more because I was connecting with my teammates more, and I was able to help the younger girls on the team, which also gave a lot of meaning, I feel like, to the, you know, struggles or things that you went through and learned. Cause it was like, now I can pass this on to someone else and I can hopefully help them to avoid some of the things that I wasn't able to.
Like, I love that you said you were like more present and had more fun. Like, that's what life is for. Nobody's, yeah. You know, I mean, I think it's remarkable everything you've done on the track, but your friends aren't going to stand there and be like, you know what I love about Elise is that she can run a 5K in under 15 minutes, right? They want to like hear you tell a story or laugh.
Exactly.
You want to be there for that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I'm really curious. Do you see yourself ever coaching?
Yeah, I would have told you Like in the beginning of my career, like especially like I'd say the first part of college, I was like, no, I don't. But the more that I've kind of learned and experienced, and I think especially just the need for more female coaches, the more that I could see myself one day coaching. Cause I, especially as you mentioned in the beginning, being involved with Voice in Sport and doing some mentorship, I just feel like, again, knowing like the role that you can have in these very developmental years and hopefully like helping younger runners and people set good habits and just be healthy, happy, confident, empowered people, I think is something that really excites me.
Well, I'm excited to see where that goes. All right. So are you ready? Are you ready for the quick set?
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Let's do this. I know you're doing a relay soon, right? Next week?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have special practices where you really just focus on baton passing technique?
No, we do not. I'm trying to think. The last time I did a relay was in college, and I think we would like maybe do like one hand off the day before to practice, but I feel like that would always be like the most stressful part of the race, because I was like, I haven't practiced this since like high school.
Yeah, like I mean, to me it seems a little bit like the transition of a triathlon. It's like, doesn't seem like a big deal, but you could waste precious seconds.
I'll have to report back on how it goes. I think we're doing like a road relay. So I think maybe I've heard it might be like a sash instead of a baton. So I think we'll have to get together and discuss, like, do you take it off early and like, I don't know exactly how the passing will work. So
yeah. Okay. I want to follow up on that. How do we pass the baton? Okay. All right. What is one thing you can't stand that most people love?
My first answer to, well, okay, now this isn't going to be quick. I would say black coffee, just straight black coffee.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Wait, that's something you feel like most people love, black coffee? Oh, wait, you're flipping. Well, it's something you love that most people hate.
No. Just, I guess I don't really drink coffee ever. So, I feel like a lot of people love coffee. Maybe it's not black then, any coffee.
Sort of coffee in general. You don't like coffee.
Yeah.
You understood my question. I did not understand your answer because I'm such a coffee drinker that I'm like, something's not computing.
Something's not working. I'll very, very occasionally drink it, but yeah, I'm not into it. And so I'd say, especially most people's love for it, I don't measure up.
You know what? That's probably a good thing though, because you travel so much. For me, like I like my coffee how I like it. So then if I travel, I'm like, what if I can't get it how I like it? For you, that's like, that's out of the mix. Who cares?
Yeah.
That makes you like a more adaptable human. What has been your most memorable race or workout?
I'd probably say the New Balance Indoor Nationals, my junior year of high school. So I feel like that was like my breakout race. And so one that I just have really fond memories of.
That's amazing. Is that the one where you had like a 20 second PR just a couple weeks after you competed in Colorado Springs? You came out to, where was this, in New York?
Yeah, I was in New York. I had like an 18 second PR, and I like won, and I think I like maybe set the meet record. And I just still remember being interviewed for it, and they were like, so you've never been to New York before? You've never run on a bank indoor track? I feel like people were just like, who is this girl?
Right.
And what is she doing?
And to put this into context for listeners, this was the mile, right?
Yeah, it was
okay. Because I feel like 20 seconds would be remarkable in the 5K, but in the mile, I mean. All right. What is your pet peeve?
I really like running through like puddles and in the mud, but having it all over my like tights and socks after and dealing with it is a pet peeve.
All right. What would you say is your superpower?
Probably asking like deep questions. Like I really like getting to know people and just like firing questions away. So.
Okay, then you need to have a podcast, because that's...
I do. I always like, I'm still adjusting to like getting on a podcast. I'm like, it's not appropriate at least to like turn it around and like deflect the question and ask the person interviewing you all the questions. I would love to do that, but maybe I'll start one and then I'll have you on and we can have a little role reversal.
That would be amazing. All right. What is the fitness gear you can't live without?
I love any of the like Nike yoga tights. I just feel like I can run in them, lounge in them, wear them all the time.
So. Okay. What's your favorite workout?
I love hills or 400 repeats on the track.
Okay. What's your favorite place to run in Boulder/Boulder County?
I love Batasso. It's one of my favorites. I like going up in the canyon, kind of being in the trees, getting some good hills. So yeah.
Batasso. Nice. All right. Dying to know, how do you avoid wedgies when you're wearing those cute little underpants sort of situations in races? What do you call those? Are those called racing briefs?
Are you talking about kind of like the, like not the spandex, but like the even shorter ones?
Yeah. Like not the booty shorts, but like they look like a bikini bottom.
Yeah. Yeah. We call them buns.
Buns. Okay. Yeah. How do we avoid wedgies in the buns?
Oh man.
Or is it not even an issue? You're just like, I don't get wedgies. I don't know what you're asking me.
I feel like it's an issue, but I feel like when I'm racing, like I'm just thinking of so many other things, not that, but like you probably don't realize until after that, like they've like rode up a lot, but I just, in the middle of a race, I guess I've just gotten used to, like, sometimes it will drive me nuts, like the first like 10 or 15 steps when you're getting out hard and you can just feel them riding up. But then I feel like I've just learned to just be like, I'm racing. I'm not going to fidget with them.
That's interesting. So I've spectated, not like, you know, from the edge of the track, but like on YouTube, on TV, and I've never seen anyone looking like they have a wedgie. So if you feel self-conscious, don't, because I don't, as a viewer, I don't see it.
Okay, good.
Maybe I hope I represent all viewers. I don't know. Where do you see yourself 5 years from now?
Hopefully still with Bowerman. I would love to keep running for a while more, hopefully, you know, continuing to grow my role with Voice in Sport and mentor, or keep hopefully changing the narrative around women's running and programs in high school and college. So not really sure what that looks like, maybe starting to get into some coaching, but yeah.
All right. Like we'll be today. And I'm going to link to Voice in Sport in the show notes, because they do offer some really cool resources. Okay. And finally, what does success mean to you?
Oh man, success means just trying to be the best version of yourself every day. And I think I've really learned that that looks different, like in anything in life. But for me, like with running, is like, there are some days that my like best is better than others. But I think to me, success is about showing up and doing the very best that you can, no matter what circumstances you're in or what's going on around you. But just knowing that if you do the best you can and you keep showing up, that's success.
That is awesome. Well, Elise, I have had so much fun with you, and I have a feeling that, I mean, some folks listening may already know you. Some folks are be like, I need more Elise in my life. Where can they find you?
They can find me on Instagram. That's pretty much all I use. I'm Elise.Cranny on Instagram.
I'll link to that in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I've loved our conversation, and thank you for all that you're doing to, push these really important conversations forward and bring more airtime to people's stories and to inspiring and helping those. So I really appreciate what you're doing, and I've loved talking to you today.
Awesome. Well, it's mutual. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you sticking with me till the end. If you liked what you heard, it would mean so much to me if you haven't already, if you would rate this podcast, give it a nice review, follow it, subscribe. And if you listen on Spotify, or even if you don't, you can now rate podcasts on Spotify, which is a relatively new thing. If you've done all those things already, I'm sending you a huge virtual hug. You can also support the show by telling a friend, text them a link to the episode, or post it on social media. And don't forget to tag me. My Instagram handle is @PamMoore303. And on Twitter, I am @PamMooreWriter. A shout out means so much to me. Additionally, if you are feeling like you are ready to change your relationship with food and your body and exercise, and you want to make space for the things in your life that really, really matter, I can help you. I am an occupational therapist with a certification as an intuitive eating coach, and it would be my pleasure to help you clear away all the mental clutter that comes with trying to manipulate the shape and size of your body. So you can get all the information you need on that on my website, pam-moore.com. Again, that's pam-moore.com. And if you would like my free guide, it's called 11 Things You Can Do Right Now to Feel Better About Your Body. You can get that on my website too. When you sign up for my newsletter at pam-moore.com,
you're going to get that free gift. And the newsletter comes, it's only every other week, and it's always a juicy tidbit, something pertaining to self-love, self-compassion, self-acceptance, intuitive eating, all that good stuff, and some links to the best things I've found, usually pertaining to those topics. Occasionally there's an outlier, but it's all good stuff, and I try to keep it super short, and that lands in inboxes every other Tuesday. Again, thank you so much for being here. Till next time, keep it real.